Hi everyone, Davinia here, and this season of Let's Make It Rain, the podcast, is sponsored by PensionBee, an online pension provider who's on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for a range of different needs, whether you're self-employed or want to invest responsibly with a fossil fuel-free or impact investing plan. Head to PensionBee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, as with all investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, for lots of us, we didn't start learning about how to save, spend, and invest our money for the future until we were well into our adulthood. I wrote Cash is Queen to change that. Cash is Queen is the world's first financial literacy book written exclusively for preteen and teenage girls, equipping them with everything they need to build solid financial foundations long before they start their first jobs. Buy it for your daughters, your nieces, your granddaughters, your goddaughters, and even yourselves. Link in show notes to find out more. Enjoy the episode. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Emma Maslin, who some of you may already know as the Money Whisperer. I'll let Emma explain why she's the Money Whisperer in a minute. Emma, thank you so much for being here today. Can you introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having me here today. So I'm Emma. I started this journey because I'm really passionate that none of us learnt about money when we were at school. I was an accountant in a previous life, but I now spend all my time in financial education. So I work with big brands, helping them get the message of financial wellness and financial growth out there. But I also work as a money coach as well. So helping people on a one-on-one and group situation to really get that handle on what's going on with their relationship with money. And my superpower, I guess, is the piece around the emotional connection that we have with money. And the neuroscience and the psychology behind our relationship is really where my fascination grew and where a lot of my training has come in.
I love that, Emma. Let's get into some of that psychology, because I think when I consider the Rainmaker community and some of the work that I do, of course, I share your passion, but also this kind of this career path in terms of working with, of course, my work is primarily with women, but it's a very similar ethos in terms of helping people to unravel their own personal relationships with money and understand some of the practical building blocks in order to establish financial resilience. But the thing that I have recognized over the last 5 years of doing this work through Raincheck is that the psychology of money is so powerful. And I think our emotional connection to money in terms of how we spend, how we save, how we think of ourselves and, you know, our ability to manage our money is such an important part of it. And I think historically has been an area that's been probably quite overlooked as we focus more on, you know, how people manage debt, why they get into debt, how they can get themselves out of debt, for example, why are people investing or not investing? And I think, you know, it's really, as we say, understanding why people do the things that they do, as opposed to just focusing on how or what, is equally as important in this whole journey. So can you talk to me about, you know, when we think about some of the work that you do around the subconscious beliefs we all have around money, which have the potential to cripple us ultimately if they go unresolved, how do you use NLP techniques? And I'll let you explain what that means to help some of your clients tap into some of these beliefs and reverse them.
So I'm going to rewind a tiny bit mm-hmm. before I answer that question, because I started off this journey by thinking, you know, I just need to tell people what to do. It's not rocket science. Personal finance is not rocket science at all. You know, if I tell them they need to do X, Y, and Z, you know, we'll all benefit. We'll all get richer. We'll all get wealthier. and people wouldn't do it. And I sit back and I think, well, it's not hard. Like, why aren't they
why
taking
aren't you doing
these
it?
Simple actions? And even they know sometimes that it's the right course of action to take, and yet they still couldn't press the button. They still couldn't take the action. Mm-hmm. And that's what really got me fascinated into the psychology behind all of this. And I'm not a psychologist. I'm a very black and white person. I was an accountant. Like I said, I'm very much like this, you take this action and this happens. But the whole brain science is so fascinating. And it's what led me initially down the path of training as an NLP practitioner. So NLP is neuro-linguistic programming. So NLP is all about how we use language and the non-verbal kind of signals that we give off. It's really fascinating in terms of just understanding how different people's brains work in different ways. Yeah, I find since doing this training, the school system is so frustrating to me because we teach everybody in the same way. Mm-hmm. And actually, some people are kinesthetic. They learn through feel, through touch. Some people are visual. Some people are auditory. And that's really important to me as a coach to understand what my coachee is like so that when we're coming up with strategies, you know, it feels good to them. Because you try and tell somebody, or not tell them what to do, but you try and encourage somebody down a particular path. And if it doesn't feel right for them, they just won't do it. They'll hit a block. But NLP is really, really useful in terms of uncovering and manipulating a lot of these limiting beliefs that we have around money. And I'm sure that your listeners and your community have heard lots about limiting beliefs. But essentially, a limiting belief is a belief that you hold to be true that limits you in some way. And there are loads of these when it comes to money, because actually, when we're growing up, a lot of the messaging around money is negative. Mm-hmm. Don't put that coin in your mouth that's dirty. Money doesn't grow on trees. Mm-hmm. Don't ask me how much I earn. That's rude. You know, there's so much that our little children have ingrained in them that just shuts down that process of talking about money. So NLP for me has been a really useful tool to be able to get people to dive into their own subconscious, recognize some of these limiting beliefs, and then we have various tools that we can use to help them build more empowering ones, which is what we need for people to effect positive change when it comes to their finances.
I mean, everything that you said there, when you touched on some of the limiting beliefs and also the fact that, you know, they are deep rooted in childhood for the most part. I mean, obviously in the work that I do in thinking about how we can transform people's relationship with money or get them off on the right foot. So inspiring the next generation of young women to really establish positive money habits from an early age. And of course, everybody already knows about Cash is Queen. I mention it on every single podcast. But, you know, even as you said, that particular point resonated with me about don't put money in your mouth, it's dirty. I mean, of course, on a practical level, it is dirty. But imagine the connotations of that over the course of your life when it's compounded by an avalanche, really, of other negative messages that we hear time and time again. Money doesn't grow on trees, or, you know, whatever it is. And we just internalize them without even thinking about it. So, Emma, just thinking, and thank you for that explanation of neuro-linguistic programming, because it's an area that I'm absolutely fascinated by as well. In terms of a practical, you know, if I'm one of your coaches and you're using one of the tools that you have, and let's say you've already established that I respond well to a particular method, what kinds of practical tools would you use on me to try and help me, I suppose, first of all, understand and unpick some of my own limiting beliefs or my own relationship with money?
So I'm going to tell you about another tool that I use, which I absolutely love alongside NLP, which is emotional freedom technique. And this
is
something
tapping?
Yeah, it is tapping. You've obviously heard of it. If your listeners haven't heard of it, tapping is essentially like acupuncture, but without the needles. And you use your own hands to tap on various places on your body whilst talking through various issues that you might have. So we might uncover that somebody has a limiting belief of, say, for example, you know, I'm terrible with money, right? That's come from somewhere. That belief hasn't just, we're not born with any of our beliefs. They are put into our belief system through what we see, hear, experience as a young child, right? So when we can acknowledge that that belief exists, we can use tapping. And obviously people can't see me here, but I'm tapping here for the video. Yeah. We use a process where we tap through various points on the face and then the body. And what that does, it activates our nervous system and it calms our nervous system down, because a lot of our emotions are stored within our body. And where we have negative emotions attached to experiences around money from when we were younger. So that might be something like seeing your parents argue about money when you were younger. That could have made you frightened. It could have made you scared that there wasn't going to be enough food on the table or whatever it might be. Okay, we can tap through and calm our body down. And that enables us to then be able to be in a different place mentally, physically, emotionally to take better action. And it is the absolute most incredible tool that I've come across. I use it in so many different areas of my life, not just for money and for my coaching, for my children when they come home and they've had a bad day with their friends. And we can kind of tap through the experience from the start to the end. What might you have done differently? How are you feeling now? It's just such a great, great way to be able to get to sleep at nighttime. You know, sometimes when your body's racing after something, it is a brilliant, brilliant tool. And it's free. You can do it yourself. So for anybody that's listening to this and thinking, that sounds interesting, go away and have a look at tapping. It is an incredible, incredible resource.
I absolutely love that. That's a real gem, I think. Because I remember when I was first introduced to the concept, it was a good friend of mine and we'd gone out for dinner and she was describing, so she's very into holistic therapies and remedies and alternative therapies. And she was going through a particularly stressful period in her life and she'd been introduced to this concept. And so while we were at dinner, she was talking me through it and she started tapping herself. And I was like, what are you doing? So she's describing this therapy. And I thought, so this is the theory that she's describing. And then suddenly she starts tapping her body. And I'm like, are you having a turn? Like, what are you doing? And I was like, people are looking at us. Can you stop doing it? And we were in stitches in the restaurant. And of course, because I'm exactly the same as you, I'm very logical, very straightforward. So of course, I was a big skeptic and I, you know, went online and had a read through. And I too was fascinated by some of the benefits. And I thought for people, you know, for anybody that is struggling, you've got nothing to lose, really, particularly something that you can do anywhere. You can do it yourself. You don't need to, you know, go to a practitioner who can help you. Of course, that would be of benefit. So if you're working with someone like Emma or someone else who's able to overlay different types of remedies and strategies together to help you build this kind of holistic solution, of course, that's the optimum remedy for lots of us. But if you're able to do something like this by yourself and feel good and release maybe some of that tension or some of that anxiety, I love what you said about doing it with your children, which is really interesting because I think quite often we don't necessarily think of our children. Yes, we recognize that they're humans and they have their own individual personalities, stresses and angst, etc. But I wonder the extent to which as parents or as adults, really, we take that seriously. And so something like this that you can involve them in is just a really nice way for you to build, you know, deepen that relationship with your children too.
Sometimes they ask me to do it at bedtime. They know how much it calms them and they feel different when they do it. So sometimes they will ask, which I think is brilliant. But I'll pop in here a reference to a great free resource, which is called The Tapping Solution. It's an app. So there's a book, there's a great documentary as well on it, but there's a free app called The Tapping Solution. And there are some money tapping exercises that are on there as well. There is a paid version with a whole lot more as well, but even the free ones are really, really great.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And I will make sure that I drop a link to those in the show notes as well. So Emma, obviously, you know that the work that I do at Raincheck focuses primarily on women. We do have some male rainmakers, but primarily women. And of course, in the course of my work and particularly my one-to-one conversations, but as well as in the group coaching, I love the group coaching sessions, actually, because I find each cohort has its own, you establish your own group norm and each cohort has its own personality. And so we might start the program with everybody a bit shy, you know, you don't know one another and you're trying to establish these relationships virtually as well. And you've got people from all over the world, different backgrounds, cultures, ages, ethnicities, all of that, which makes for a brilliant conversation. But I find over the course of the program, over the period of 6 or 12 months, things start to come out. And the women start to relax and feel more confident sharing some of the beliefs that they hold about money. And we're talking some really powerful women, ambitious, talented, you know, super successful in all of the different ways. And whenever I say that to them, they're always like, oh, Dav, why are you saying this? And I'm like, because it's true, you know, from the outside looking in, you are somebody that's achieved great things. And of course, there are a number of studies around the ways that women shrink themselves in all of the different ways. But when it comes to money, of course, we have a lot of negative stories that we tell ourselves about our competence in managing money. From your perspective, Emma, do you notice a difference, given that, if I understand correctly, you work with clients across the board, not just women, but men and women? Is that correct?
I do work with anybody and everybody, but predominantly women. But I have worked with men. Yeah.
Okay. And do you notice a difference in terms of the stories that some of your male clients are telling themselves about their relationship with money versus your female clients? And or are there any patterns? Is there some commonality in terms of the misconceptions we hold about our competence managing money?
Well, I think it's a bit of a generalization to talk about women in general feeling that they're not competent, because there are certain people that feel competent and act competently, and there are those that aren't. But I do think that as women, and we're going to talk a little bit later about money personalities, women do tend to show up as the nurturers. You know, biologically, we are programmed to look after our community, our children, our elderly parents, you know, and that sometimes means that we tend to lack that action of kind of putting on our own oxygen mask first. And so I don't think sometimes it's not a competence gap, it's really confidence, and we're spread too thinly as well. And I think that's that piece around we look after other people first and we tend to put ourselves last. And that's something that we do need to change when it comes to money, because the only way that we can really look after everybody else effectively is to be financially well and secure. When it comes to the confidence piece, I think that women just need what you, what I, what lots of people out there are now providing, which is this community to say, yep, we weren't taught about this stuff at school, but hey, we want to learn, and we want to be in an environment where, A, it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to put your hand up and say, do you know what? I just don't understand this. And to share in each other's wins and losses as well. Because I think generally money is seen as one of those things that's a bit of a game to be won. And that isn't always the case. You know, I think it's really important that we share where we've done things wrong and build each other's competence and confidence. And it's that confidence piece that I think women are lacking.
Absolutely. And I wholeheartedly agree with you, particularly around the point about there not necessarily being a competence gap. I mean, there's so many studies that point to the fact that, you know, when we look at investing, if you take investing as an individual aspect of our personal finances, I think it was Warwick Business School that did that study that pointed to the fact that when women do invest, we outperform men. And whenever I talk about that point, I always stress the fact that it's not about us necessarily trying to compete with men or trying to outpace men, but it's more about the fact that women really need to be reminded of the fact that when you do this, you're actually really good at it. And if that's one of the ways, among many, that can help you reverse perhaps some of the ideas you have about your ability to manage your money, then we need to keep on repeating it. Similarly, when we look across households, across the globe, actually, whether women's primary work is exclusively within the home or within the home and outside the home, women are typically, of course, not always, more likely to be responsible for managing the household purse. So making sure that the bills are being paid, that there are groceries, that, you know, things are just, that they're paying, you know, if they have children, that, you know, all of the different clubs and classes, the subscriptions are being paid. They're just responsible for managing that budget. And I think it's a thing because we do it as a matter of course without necessarily tapping into the fact that that's a massive responsibility, you know, making sure that the household is financially solvent and things are running in good order. We don't necessarily give ourselves the credit we deserve. So there is a lot about giving ourselves grace and recognizing that we actually have all of the competence and all of the aptitude to plug any gaps from a practical perspective. And so, as you quite rightly say, perhaps confidence is more of the thing that we need to point to as well, whilst recognizing that it doesn't apply to all women. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I also think to add to that point, women are often assumed in the financial press to be risk averse. And that really irks me because I don't think that we're risk averse. We're much more risk aware for exactly all of those reasons that you just said. You know, we've got to make sure that there's food on the table. We've got to make sure the bills are paid. It makes you aware of the here and now. And so the risk of doing something else with our money is so much bigger for somebody that's focused on making sure that not only ourselves, but our others, again, are secure in the here and now. And that's where we have a big role to play in terms of educating people about risk and making sure that whatever they are doing with their money is risk appropriate. It doesn't mean shying away from risk, because risk is an essential part of becoming a wealthy woman, right? But it's about making sure that you understand what risk is and that you're taking the appropriate risk for your situation, but definitely not shying away from it.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, the two points there, I mean, your point about risk, we take risks every day of our lives, you know, whether we choose to invest or not invest, choose a particular investment instrument or another one, there are risks associated with everything, including holding the money in cash. So exactly as you say, it's about taking the appropriate risk for our personal circumstances. And then a secondary point, you know, I think in the midst of the pandemic, and we know all of the different stresses and strains that all of us were under, but disproportionately women, as you rightly say, we are typically, or we tend to be, we have a tendency to be the nurturer. But I think it was Living Wage Foundation that said that the, of course, everybody's financial awareness, if you like, was heightened. And for lots of people, financial stress was amplified as a result of the pandemic. And women disproportionately bore the vast majority of that stress because of the fact that we are responsible in most situations for managing that household purse. So as inflation really started to bite and we're thinking, gosh, utility bills are going up, the cost of groceries is going up, you know, putting petrol in the car is going up, women would have been on the front line in absorbing those stresses in the first instance, before they had an opportunity to discuss it with their partners, perhaps, if you have a partner, or with other members in your community, in your little bubble. And so it really is important that we recognise that actually our situations are not necessarily equal. So we cannot just stand, when we're standing on the curbside looking at everything and saying, gosh, why do I feel like I'm out of control with my money? Why do I feel that I'm terrible with money? We're already under so much pressure without us necessarily acknowledging it. So I think that's really important to say. So we talked about, or you touched on money personalities, and I absolutely love this theory or framework, money script. We know that, you know, frameworks like that, there are lots of criticisms of anything that, you know, tries to categorize people in that way. But I think the thing that I love about it is for the first time, it's given people an opportunity to consider how different personality traits influence and impact our relationship with money and where some of those traits might have come from. So given the work that you do, I suppose there's two parts to the question. What kinds of money personalities do you see? And do you believe that they can be changed over the long term? Or do you think that there are certain aspects that are hard-coded and therefore difficult to uproot?
Okay, big question.
Yeah. I feel like that's the whole podcast, isn't it?
Well, I get all of my clients to take a money personality assessment before we even get started. Because for me, there is no one size fits all when it comes to money. And we each have this very different lens through which we view the world because of our underlying personality. And let's be quite clear, your money personality is a subset of your bigger personality. And actually, the lady who devised the framework that I work with, she says, how you do money is how you do everything. And it very clearly comes through to people when you take the assessment. You know, if you're somebody like me, who's quite anal, who likes everything in order, who's a bit of a control freak, you know, I'm like that with my money. I like to have the spreadsheet. My husband gets to look at it once a month, but it's me that controls it. We see everybody through from my kind of personality, where I like to see money accumulating. So that's called the accumulator in my framework, through to the emotional spenders, the spontaneous people, those who use money to elevate themselves in the eyes of others, the kind of celebrity, the status-driven people, the nurturer who we talked about, you know, the people who actually their money tends to be directed to others at the expense sometimes of themselves. So there's a whole raft of dominant archetypes or personalities, but actually we're all a mix of all of them. It's just which one we default into when we're in our subconscious brain. And this is where all the psychology is really, really interesting, because your second question is, can we change our money personality? Some people would say you can. For me, with the work that I do, having the knowledge of what your default is so useful, because it enables you to see where your strengths are. It also enables you to see what the challenges are of that particular personality type. And it's that knowledge, that awareness, that then enables you to make changes down the track. So it's not about changing your personality per se. It's about how does that knowledge give you the foundations to then change your behaviours, which is ultimately what we want, right? You know, if you know that you're somebody who is a spontaneous spender, having that knowledge and understanding what some of those challenges are for you, like if I go out with friends, I find it really hard to say no. When I'm bored, I shop on Instagram, you know, all of those things, they're your triggers when you know what those triggers are, then you can choose to do something different about it. And that's what we work on in my coaching. And it might be that we go down the path, first of all, of having a strategy which is somatic, so body. So it might be tapping. When I'm triggered, I then do this action, which is a body piece of work to calm my nervous system, because I've defaulted into my natural behavior, which is to spend money. But when I know that that's what I do, I can take a breath and I can take an action that will help me bring you away from that default action. And then I can choose a different strategy instead. And that then can be a different practical strategy, right? So that's where the change can come in. It's not about changing your money personality per se. It's about using the knowledge of what you tend to do and what those traits of personality are, so that when you're triggered in various directions, you can choose different strategies to take.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense, particularly. And I like actually those different depictions of the different personalities, because I'm sure lots of us can relate to them. One of the things that I quite often think, and you're quite right, it is circumstantial, isn't it, in terms of how you behave in different scenarios. One of the things that I touch on in Cash's Queen is talking about, you know, who's in your tribe. And if you imagine as young people, you know, the grandparents, parents, I'm sure all of us growing up will have heard, you know, you're known by the company you keep, you know, be careful about your friends, all of this kind of thing. And it's a similar thing when you become an adult, you know, how do you, does your behavior change when you're in a professional environment versus when you're with your family versus when you're with friends? Is there a particular friend that spurs you or motivates you to behave in one way or another, both positively or negatively? Or actually, it could just be a neutral thing. And so I suppose in being able to make those neutral, non-judgmental observations about ourselves and our behaviors is what sets us on the right path to being able to decide to take a course of action or not. But I love the idea of being able to identify them and then saying, these are some prescribed actions that you might take, but you have the, obviously it's within your gift to choose whether or not you intend to take them.
One of the best things that you can do to actually become aware of some of the things you've just talked about is to keep a journal of, not when we talk about money journaling, it's not about saying, well, I spent £2 on this and £5 on that. It's about saying, when I spent that £5, what time of day was it? What day was it? What was I doing beforehand? Who was I with? How was I feeling? So you're building up a picture of what those triggers are that cause the spending. And often when you do that for a period of maybe 3 or 4 weeks, you can really clearly see what those triggers are. Are they a particular person? Is it a particular tribe? Is it a time of day? You know, people often say to me, well, I had to take the kids to their swimming lesson, so I've got to wait around for an hour, so I go and grab a coffee, right? That's a trigger, okay? And when you become aware of it, then you can challenge it. But keeping that journal is a really nice way to see some of those patterns.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big advocate of journaling just in general, just as a way to purge. So, for example, if you were working with me, Emma, and, you know, you talked about the different types of clients and the way they, you know, what they respond well to. I'm somebody that loves writing. I love reading. I love writing. And so every day I'll be writing something down about just in general what's happened this week or this month. What were the highlights? What were the lowlights? I find it quite a cathartic and soothing process, where someone else might be like, oh, God, Dav, I hate writing. And then you would find an alternative technique for them. But that is a very powerful way, exactly as you described, for me, in identifying patterns in my behavior and what else was happening at that time, what other stresses and strains were happening, what was the context within which I wrote this particular entry.
Yeah, it could be super, super useful.
So, yeah. So thinking about, and we've touched on one of the areas, you know, thinking about the challenges that women confront when it comes to their finances, whether they are intrinsically linked or extrinsically linked. What do you see as the number one challenge facing women when it comes to their money? And what advice would you give to women listening around how they might resolve it?
So I might go a bit controversial here. I like controversy. Well, especially because you and I are talking now, and we use social media as a means to communicate with our audiences. Mm-hmm. I actually think social media is a real challenge.
Preach.
There are so many shoulds that people get from social media. You should be investing. You should have a pension. You should be working. You should also be an amazing mum. You should be an amazing wife. You should. And wow, we're shoulded out. And If that's
even as you were saying it, I'm like, oh God, my head's about to explode. By the time you got to "we should be an amazing mom" in the list, I'm like, oh God, like, it's terrible.
We can't do everything, yeah. Right? And it, social media puts us in a position where we feel that we should be as good as the next person and keeping up with the Joneses. And my biggest piece of advice to people is to really stay in your own lane. You know, get that clarity on what is it that you're aiming for, and then go searching for the solutions that will help you get there. Because when we just get bombarded in a push direction from everything that's available to us on social media, it can become really, really overwhelming. And I think that that's where some people just shut down when it comes to finances. You know, I've got information overload. And I've probably got a bit of emotional work to do as well around my relationship with money. And that's when they just stop. And what we want is for people to be taking action. So social media has its benefits, but it also is a huge kind of noose around a lot of people's necks, I think.
Yeah. No, I love that. And actually, I mean, it's so true. When you think about, I mean, take emotional spending, for example. If you are somebody that is prone to emotional spending, let's say that, you know, somebody has done your money personalities quiz, they've had a conversation with you and they recognize, actually, I'm somebody that is prone to emotional spending or impulse spending. And we know that women are the biggest users on Instagram, for example. And now they've made it even easier for us to tap on something. Suddenly you click a button, you click a little handbag, and then you're through to a website. And within two or three clicks, you bought something that maybe you didn't actually intend to buy when you set out on, you know, when you clicked Instagram and you're like, I'll just have a bit of a casual scroll. Well, first of all, the casual scroll, and I know for myself, my casual, it's just going to be 10 minutes. 2 hours later, I'm like, oh my God, no wonder I've got a headache. But then you're three purchases down. It's so easy. And of course, that's one particular example, but there are many others. And we really do need to be mindful of not just the upsides of social media and how it can help us form community and share knowledge, but also some of the insidious effects too. I mean, I find, for example, TikTok. I know that there are lots of users of TikTok. I am not a personal user of TikTok, though we have attempted to have a presence there from a range check perspective. I don't really think that it's the platform for us, but the sheer volume of material on TikTok, I find it so overwhelming. It really raises my anxiety in a really visceral way. I find myself almost feeling like my body fizzing if I go on there and you watch one video and then immediately there are thousands of others seemingly without relent. So yeah, that's a really, really interesting point. It'd be interesting to see when people listen to this, how they perceive their personal relationship with social media to be.
Yeah, I think it's so hard though now because we live so much of our lives through social media. You know, I do have social media detoxes. I also am not on TikTok because it's just a platform. It would have overwhelmed me. I don't choose to look at anything on it. I don't have any interaction with it at all.
I think that's wise.
You know, each to their own. But I think, you know, we didn't have that growing up. And it does worry me for our children's generation and the generations to come, how that overwhelm will lead to such problems in terms of being able to focus on anything else. Because what you've just described, what is overwhelm? And when your body's in that situation, you go into fight, flight mode. You're not working in the right part of your brain. Your prefrontal cortex is shutting down when it's overwhelmed. It just goes into freeze mode. And we can't make sensible decisions about anything, let alone our money, when we're in that freeze mode. It's a scary thing.
Absolutely. I like what you just said about taking social media detoxes, because I think, you know, there are situations in which when we get to that point of overwhelm, and of course, again, we have to be tuned into our bodies and what's happening with our bodies in order to identify what's going on. But being able to take a step back and say, and actually recognize, how do I feel, you know, 24 hours later, you know, do you find your thumb twitching and hovering over the Instagram button or TikTok or Facebook or whatever it is? In which case, that's, you know, perhaps a sign that you need to keep going for a bit longer until you don't have those urges and those impulses. But I say that as somebody that is very type A. I've got an addictive personality and I know that about myself. I do things at speed and have done since I was a small child, very determined, very fast. I speak quickly, I move quickly, I have a lot of energy. You know, I have to be doing something active every day. And so working out is a really important part of my personal well-being contract with myself, if you like. And so social media for me is potentially, I don't want to say dangerous, I don't want to be dramatic about it, but it's one of those things, it's like a black hole. And I can start off being super disciplined about it, but if I don't have certain parameters around myself in terms of my usage, quite quickly, I am that person that could be on there for 3 hours and then lamenting the loss of time and recognizing, you know, all the talk, all my work around opportunity cost. What else could you have been doing with that time, Dav? It then just leads me into a spiral of self-loathing. So I know I really need to keep a check and keep a handle on myself. So I can just imagine, you know, what it feels like for other people. Hopefully they are less type A than I am.
I'm smiling here at this end because actually I'm sitting here today, 6 years or so down the track from starting this journey because of social media, because I worked out that my husband watches a lot of football and I was sitting on the sofa next to him, bored, not really paying attention to the football. And I worked out that I was spending about 15 hours a week scrolling mindlessly through social media. So I said to myself, I'm going to swap that time and do something creative. And I built myself a website and the website became the Money Whisperer blog. And 6 years down the track, here I am. And my journey has actually come from that initial social media detox.
Brilliant. And there are so many examples like that, Emma. And I love that because I think this is not, it shouldn't feel like a social media bashing exercise. We get a lot of joy from it. You know, for lots of us who can manage it well, there are so many sparks of inspiration. You might get a nugget of information that validates a thought that you'd previously had, or it teaches you something new. And there are lots of, particularly women that I hear who can share, you know, actually, my business was built out of a Facebook group, or it was built out of an Instagram page, or whatever it is. So it really is just about having that moderation and balance so that you are not out of control. It's the same thing that I always say to people about their money. You are in control of your money is not in control of you. Same thing with social media. So now I want to talk about pensions specifically, because, I mean, this is an area that's a source of huge stress for many of us. And it's a thing that comes up frequently within the Rainmaker community. If it's not investing, then it's pensions. And we know that the two things are entwined. So if you had a magic wand, what would you do to close the gender pension gap? And I suppose we know that there is this gap that exists in terms of women's later life outcomes from a financial perspective versus our male counterparts. And this is based on, you know, data and research. So if you were able to do something to tackle it, what would you do? What would you say to people from an individual perspective, but then I suppose more broadly from a policy or company level?
Well, let me tell you a little story about myself. So I have two little girls. They're not so little anymore. One's 9, one's 11. And I am really conscious that they are going into a world where there is still a gender pay gap, a gender pensions gap. And with that in mind, I set them up their own pensions when they were younger. I put £2,500 into each of their pensions. And I recognise that that's a very privileged position to be in, to be able to do that. But I don't intend to put any more money in that for them. So that was my contribution to them. It got the government tax relief on top of that. So what they have in their pension pot to start off is a little bit over £3,000. And if you assume that money kind of doubles every 10 years or so as a broad rule of thumb, by the time that they want to take that money when they are 60, bearing in mind that I set these up for them both when they were under 10, so they've got a good 50 years for it to grow, that £3,000 should grow into a nice, healthy about £100,000, which coincidentally is roughly what the gender pensions gap is. So I've done my little bit for my girls.
I love that.
To help them be able to get to a stage where they're in their 20s, 30s, maybe later, where they want to have children and they can step away from work. They can have their time with their children, be that short, be that long, without that worry that it's impacting their longer term retirement savings, because running alongside is this nice little pension that mummy set up when they were little. So I recognise that's not something
that is
not
fabulous.
Everybody can do that. But I think it's a really important message that shows the value of compound interest is really highlighted there, that the earlier you start, relatively small amounts can grow into huge, huge, meaningful sums when we're talking about leaving that for 50 plus years. So that's my little nugget for people who are out there who maybe have children. And that obviously applies to boys and girls. But I think from my perspective, it was really my stand against the gender pensions gap that, you know, I will do my bit to make sure that they don't end up with a lesser pension than a male counterpart. So that's individual level. That's my little tip there.
Love it. I think that the other thing to highlight there is that for those people that are listening that are like, what on earth? child pensions do exist. And so, you know, for anybody that's thinking, how do I save and invest on behalf of my children, or it could be godchildren or whomever, there are a number of services and products out there that are specifically targeting children. So Junior ISAs, for example, where you've got £9,000, can save or invest up to £9,000 tax-free in every tax year. And you can do stocks and shares or cash. There are child pensions. Lots of people do premium bonds. There are so many different products and services that exist. Do be mindful that if you're investing into a pension, then they can't get access to the money until they are pension age. But what a brilliant start for them in thinking about their retirement planning. So yeah, that's a brilliant tip, Emma, for anybody listening.
So what about the other areas? So policy level, you know, it's really hard to affect change. Otherwise, we wouldn't have this gap. But I think auto-enrolment in general, where employed people are auto-enrolled into their workplace pension, has had huge success in the last 10 or 11 years since it was introduced. You know, we've seen 10 million more people saving for their retirement that weren't previously saving, which is huge. The sad thing is that self-employed people don't get the same benefits. And for me, I think that when women hit childbearing age, that's the time when the gender pension gap really starts to widen. We get people who maybe don't necessarily go back into paid employment, and they might go into self-employment. And if there was a mechanism by which a self-employed person, when they register their company for corporation tax, register with Companies House, if they could also be automatically auto-enrolled into a pension, so that that first hurdle of setting the pension up was done for them, and all they had to do was set up monthly contributions, I just think that that would have a massive impact for a lot of women who are like us, you know, working for themselves, probably for lifestyle choices at this stage in our life. It's just a small thing, but I think that the self-employed do get a bit of a bum deal when it comes to pensions. So that would be my little top tip. If anybody in the government would like to act on that, that would...
It's a brilliant tip.
I think it would make a real difference. But I think, you know, company-wise, we need to educate people. If I'd have known when I was in paid employment that if I made extra contributions when I was in my 20s, I would really bolster up my pension for that period where I stepped away from work. And for me, I had these ideals that I was going to have a child and I was going to go back after 9 or 12 months. And for me, it ended up being 4 years that I was out, because I had my children and my whole life changed, and my goals changed and my motivations changed, and I didn't go back to paid employment. So for me, if I'd have known the impact of extra contributions in my 20s, I think it would have hit home. So I think we've got a role to do to play to really educate those women at the start of their careers of how important early life contributions are.
Yeah, you know, I was going to ask you, it's a brilliant point that you make, and actually it's something that I share, in that I have had a pension since I was 22. It was one of the things that was drummed into me by my mom. Shout out to my mom. But an understanding of how much I should be contributing, whether it was enough, whether and how I could make additional contributions if I wanted to, and what the impact of those additional contributions might be, where the pension was invested. Now, of course, at least I had a general awareness of that. You know, I worked for an asset management firm working on institutional pension funds. So at least I knew that, you know, my pension is an investment. But I was very blasé about it. I mean, at 22, 23, I was like, you know, I felt really grown up. I've got my big girl panties on. I've moved from Birmingham to London and I'm excited. And I'm like, I'm getting myself in order. I'm buying a flat. I'm doing all of these amazing things. I had no idea. Pension was the furthest thing from my mind. In my mind, I was like, I've got one. So presumably, since I've got one, it's going to do what I need it to do when I'm ready to retire. I don't need to think about it. It's happening. The money's just being deducted out of my payslip. Surely someone else has done the thinking around whether or not this is enough for me to live on. You mean I've got to decide or establish whether it's enough for me to live on? How on earth am I going to do that? And you're quite right. I think the education around, first of all, understanding or recognizing the importance of pension planning as early as you possibly can, and understanding the impact of compounding as that multiplier effect. But also, I think there still is a knowledge gap. Not just, this is not a female-centric issue. This is just across the board. Does anybody really know how much they need to be saving on a monthly basis into their pension in order to retire comfortably, or at least retire to the same standard of living that they have today? I think very few of us do. So how could we go about identifying that number? from your perspective?
So I personally found it really hard to see what I was doing when I had different pots in different places. So if you've worked in multiple jobs, A, there's an admin issue there. You know, you're getting statements from some places. Some might, you might be looking at your balances on an app. For me, consolidating all my pensions into one place was the first step to really knowing, A, what I had right now. Because what you have right now is your starting block for what you're aiming for. That, for me, was the first step, consolidating everything so I could see what I was doing. And also, there's sometimes a benefit to doing that as well, in that if you have lots of little pots, you're paying fees on all of those pots. By the time your pot gets considerably bigger, often pension firms will charge lower fees when you've got a bigger pot. So there's a financial consideration there as well. Right, so when I've got my pot all in one place, that then enables you to be able to say, well, how is that going to grow? What do I need to do? What do I need to be adding now or regularly to get me to the pot of the size that I want? But then there's the next question. Well, how big is that pot? How much do I need when I'm older? Now, there's some really, really great research being done by the Pensions and Lifetimes Savings people. They've created the retirement living standards, which they want to be like the five a day. You know, we all know that we should be eating our five a day of fruit and vegetables. They want the same type of thinking around people's pension savings. So they've created a really easy to digest profile of what you might need depending on how you want to live your retirement. So they've divided what retirement looks like into three fairly standardized models. The first one is a minimum kind of retirement standard of living. Then you've got a moderate one, then you've got a comfortable one. And the difference between the minimum and the comfortable is sort of, you know, whether you're going to holiday for a week in England a year or whether you're going to go for 3 weeks to Europe. Whether you're going to change your car every 3 years or whether you're not going to have a car at all and not run your own personal transport. So they've got these baskets of what those different retirement plans look like. Well, not plans, but retirement lifestyles look like. And it's a really nice way to be able to see, well, hang on, what do I want to be able to do in retirement? Do I want to be able to travel? Is it important to me to be able to do hobbies and eat out regularly? Or am I okay with just having a budget of £60 a week on food, right? So once you can start having those questions with yourself and placing yourself into one of those three categories, that then determines, well, how much money might I need? So just to give you an idea, for a single person to live the comfortable lifestyle, so that's like the premium lifestyle, you would need £37,000 per year. Right. So then you can reverse engineer that. What does that look like? How much does my pot need to be to enable me to withdraw £37,000 a year for the rest of my life? OK, so it's a really, really nice idea to just start thinking about what you want retirement to look like and then using these retirement living standards to be able to say, OK, if I put myself in one of these categories, that gives me the idea of how much money I'm then going to need to get to. Then you can reverse engineer that. What have I got right now? And you can start playing around with a lot of the calculators that are out there. So I'm a PensionBee customer. PensionBee have got a great app, the pension calculator. So you can put in what's the size of your pension now? What sort of contributions are you planning to make? What contributions is your employer making? You can factor in the state pension. So if you are eligible for the maximum state pension, you will get £10,500 just over per year currently. You know, who knows what that might be when you get to state retirement age, whenever that might be for you. But you can play around with all these different metrics and see what that does in terms of that final pot. So it's a really, really good way to start this process of thinking about how big do I need my pot to be and how can I go about getting it there.
I love that. They're great tips. I particularly like the idea of doing that kind of scenario planning, or just, you know, kind of forecasting what kind of lifestyle do I want. And I, you know, it's one of the exercises that we do within the Rainmaker community, because, and it's more from the perspective of just getting people's brains adjusted to the idea that, you know, a point in time in future, it may feel like it's decades away, you will be retired. How can you be in control of that from today? And it doesn't mean you have to obsess about it every day of your life, but it does mean that you need to maybe make some tweaks, put some infrastructure in place so that you are contributing enough to lead you towards the kind of lifestyle that you want. But then the fun part of it is kind of conceiving of what kind of retirement might you like to have. You know, we talk all the time, I say we talk all the time, social media is screaming all the time about those people that are retiring early, retiring at 40. I'm sure if you're 25, the idea of retiring at 40 may sound attractive. But for those of us, putting my hand up, who have reached 40, are thinking, well, the idea that I would have retired at 40 is just ridiculous to me now, because I'd be completely bored because I love the work that I'm doing. So what does it look like instead? You know, do you plan to retire later in life? And what does that look like exactly? As you said, are you taking holidays or not? Where do you live? Do you drive? And I think working through some of those considerations can help people to visualize in practical terms rather than just numbers what your retirement reality might look like. So thank you for sharing those tools and tips. Okay, so now let's talk a bit about you, Emma. Let's dig about around into your personal financial situation, if we may, and your own relationship with money. So of course, this is a podcast about women and wealth and our approaches to building sustainable long-term wealth. But that, of course, that journey for lots of us involves ups and downs and mistakes, money mistakes, as well as money wins. So can you share with us one of your best financial investments or money wins and one of your worst?
I think my biggest win is having had knowledge of diversification. And by diversification, we mean having fingers in lots of pies. So for me, I'm a landlord and I've been an investor since I was 25. I have a pension that I'm actively contributing into. I have some premium bonds because that's where my emergency fund sits. I think it's really important to acknowledge, you know, that's a relatively small win, I think, in terms of best investment. But I think diversification is probably my best financial win because it's enabled me to not feel quite so anxious when certain things happen in the economy. You know, when there's talking about house prices crashing, you know, it doesn't stress me out too much because I've got some shares. Having a diversified portfolio enables us to be able to breathe easier and sleep easier because we're not reliant on one particular thing to keep us afloat or keep us in those retirement goals.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I love that. And the thing is, that principle of diversification applies to so many other things as well, doesn't it? You know, just not putting all your eggs in one basket, full stop. So yeah, completely understand how it's a great stress mitigator or diffuser, for sure. And what's been your worst?
My worst? Well, I did start investing when I was 25 and I had no guidance. I didn't have parents who were investors. I was working in a big four accountancy firm and seeing lots of people around me asking questions that I didn't really know the answers to. So I thought, and I worked in corporate finance, valuing companies, actually. That was my specialism. And I didn't have any shares of my own. So I was like, right, I need to dive into this. So I got into investing in totally the wrong way by stock picking. When I say totally the wrong way, it's not necessarily the wrong way, but we would always encourage people to think about diversifying and, you know, getting into investing by investing through funds, which are baskets of lots of different companies, is going to spread your risk far better than picking one. And at the time that I got into investing, it was the global financial crisis. And I was living in Australia. I was working in Melbourne. And we pretty much escaped the global financial crisis over there. Australia was booming. China was buying all the stuff that was coming out of the Australian mines. The Australian mining stocks were absolutely booming. And so I went all in on Australian mining stocks. And I still have a couple in my broker over in Australia that went down to absolutely not, like pence. As a reminder to myself of how dangerous penny picking stocks is. So that was my worst. It was great in terms of a learning curve. And thankfully I didn't put millions in there because I didn't have millions at the time. I still don't have millions. But
you didn't bet your house on it.
But it was a really valuable learning experience and one that I keep there to remind myself not to be greedy and to put in place all of the principles that I now preach around sensible investing and doing the right thing.
I had a similar experience with Israeli biotech stocks. So it's the same thing. Nothing against Israeli biotech stocks. I'm sure that there are lots of really highly performing ones. But my, I mean, my stock decision's just bombed. Terrible. I am somebody that likes funds. I like fund investing. So yeah, but that's brilliant. Thank you so much for sharing, Emma. So we talk all the time at Raincheck about the different aspects of wealth, what it means to be a wealthy woman. And we know that for us, wealth is derived not just of our financial wealth, but also emotional wealth, spiritual, mental wealth, all of these different things that contribute towards our overall, not just wealth portfolio, but feeling of wealth, of wellness. What steps are you taking to be a wealthy woman? And what does it mean to be a wealthy woman to you?
Well, what is wealth? You know, money, all money is, it's an enabler. It just enables us to be able to live the life that we choose to live. So for me on a personal level, but also for my clients, we do a similar thing to what you've already explained. You know, having that vision of what it is that you want to achieve out of life is so, so important. And I always say that money coaching isn't about the money. It's so much bigger than that. It's about, you know, what it is that you want to be able to sit back on your rocking chair when you're 90 and look back on life and say, yeah, I achieved everything I wanted to achieve, roughly when I wanted to achieve it. Everyone's happy, everyone's healthy. We did it in our lane, you know. So in terms of what I'm doing, having that regular planning session, and a planning session makes it sound like something big. It isn't something big. It's about having conversations with my husband, making sure that the things that we thought were goals last year are still goals, making sure that we're in check in terms of what we're looking forward to, when that might happen, making adjustments when stuff happens and we have to make sure that we are on track to achieve what we want to achieve. So a big part of that for me is about knowing what my personal values are. And I think this is one of the core things I really wish our children were taught at school around values and living a life that's aligned with your own personal values. Because once I did this exercise for myself with a coach, I gave up various things to do with work. I completely shifted how I worked, because for me, my personal value of family is my top value. So now I've got children, haven't gone back to paid employment. I realised I was doing certain things in my job that were keeping me away from my children at bedtime. You know, I was scheduling in calls after 7 o'clock, when actually I was like, it's so counterintuitive and so misaligned to my values that I cut them out straight away. How can I say that my top value is family, and yet sometimes my children are saying, "Mommy, why can't you put me to bed tonight?" You know, it's crazy. So doing values work and really getting clear on what it is that you value the most, what your value set is, it helps drive so many decisions with ease in life in general, not just around money, but it does help with money. And I help people do this in terms of their budgeting as well. When you know what your values are, it's really easy to say, I'll direct my money to the top values. Then when there's no money left, okay, it's easy to say, well, I'm not going to buy that gym subscription, because do you know what? Health and fitness isn't as high as X, Y, and Z in my value set. And so I'm okay with cutting that out, because actually I'd rather direct that money that I have got towards the things that are meaningful for me. If that's connection, then I'd rather divert that money to having a monthly or bi-monthly meal out with my friends, because that gives me something that I need in terms of who I am as a person. So values and goals are what drive, you know, my wealthy woman journey, really.
I love that. And it's a brilliant exercise to do with, I mean, doing it with your husband is brilliant. And I think that's an important step anyway, whether, you know, you are married or, you know, just, you know, cohabiting with a person. It's important that you do have that alignment, because one of the things that I hear quite commonly from some of my rainmakers, not all, is, you know, there comes a point, you know, people evolve and evolve. You know, you might have been with someone since you were in your 20s, you're now in your 40s. And if you're not checking in with that person, not just about, of course, finance is kind of at the heart of lots of other things that are happening in a relationship. And if you're not regularly checking in with one another, you can find that you're diverging in terms of what your aspirations are. You're planning to retire in 5 years, your partner's planning to retire in 20 years, and you're thinking, oh, I thought we were retiring together and we were hanging out together in retirement. So that's really important. But I also think it's a really nice exercise to do in a group, you know, with a group of friends or siblings, you know, family members or whatever, and just to kind of brainstorm with one another, get clear on your own values, and then kind of take them away and really interrogate them and what's really important to you. So I love that. And I especially love the way that you've linked that back to, you know, your budgeting and some of the other practical aspects of your personal finance activity that you might be performing. So Emma, my final question then before we get to our quick fire is just thinking about financial freedom, because this is again one of those terms that's bandied about quite commonly on social media. Some of us, you know, use it in our, you know, it's become part of our vocabulary as well, but it means different things for different people. For some of us, it's of course it's about being debt free. For others, it's never having to work again. What does it mean to you? And I guess what's the most powerful money move you've made on your financial journey to lead you towards financial freedom, if you haven't already achieved it?
It's a really meaningful question, isn't it? I think financial wellness is about that base level and not feeling stress. Financial freedom is beyond that. It's about thriving when it comes to our finances. But I'm always really conscious that people don't elevate money into something that it's not. You know, money is only one cog of the wheel of our life. And if anyone's ever done the wheel of life exercise where you look at the different components of your life, you know, money and finances is an enabler. Like I've said, it's only one component. Yeah, it is. So for me, financial freedom is something that I don't try and make into something more than it's not. For me, I've stepped back from a career. I actually had a really interesting conversation with my parents recently. I'm 42 and in July, a lot of the partners, so I used to work for EY, Big Four accountancy firm, and all the new partner announcements come out on the 1st of July. And lots of my cohort were made partners this year and have done for the previous few years. And I was saying to my parents how, oh, if I'd have stuck with it, that would have been me. And there's some little part of me that thinks, what if? But there's a much bigger part that knows that my wheel of life is very balanced. So I have time with my children, which is something that I really, really value. I'm doing rewarding work that I know is going to give me a much bigger legacy, I think, than had I stayed in my employed work. You know, and all the other components of our life, my home life, I'm able to do the things I love. Like I love cooking for the children. I love cooking for friends and family. And that's because I haven't elevated earning lots. Because if I'd have done that, I would have been commuting into London. I would have been sacrificing various other areas of my life. So I think that for me, financial freedom is about having that balance in that wheel of life and not making one or other element too pronounced at the expense of others.
Emma, I absolutely love that, because as you were talking, it just, and I'm 42 as well. And sometimes I will cast my mind back to, you know, my life in the corporate world and, you know, all of my aspirations and ambitions and where I would be. And it's even on occasion, you know, how much I'd be earning and what my bonus would be and all of these sorts of things. And, you know, you have to grieve that and kind of mourn the loss of that alternative life, but then reflect on, my God, look at how much richer my life is today, not necessarily in the financial wealth, but all of those other aspects, exactly as you've described. And I think it's having that anchor, isn't it? That anchor into what are my values? What is really important to me? Because it's so easy for us to compare current life with potential alternative life, but also to compare ourselves with others. And I think one of the best defenses against that is to be clear on what it is that you actually truly value versus strangers on the internet or your peers who you absolutely love, support and champion, but just recognize that life is not for me. So brilliant, brilliant way to wrap up before we get to our quick fire round. So I'm just going to ask you three very quick questions. First answer that comes to mind. So what's one money lesson you learned early on that you swear by?
My dad always used to say, don't be afraid of taxes. You wouldn't pay taxes if you don't earn them. So I don't have the same anxiety as a lot of people when it comes to tax. And I always have my dad in my ear when I'm filling in my tax return. I'm like, this is a positive thing because my business is doing well.
Yes. Brilliant. Look, you know what? I'm going to channel your dad too when I do my tax return. Money is no object. What are you blowing the budget on?
Oh, holidays, memories. Like I say, my children, they're not going to be around. They're not going to want a holiday with me forever. So spending that time making memories and good food. I do. If money was no object, I would have a chef 100% because I love food And I love the way that food brings people together. So yeah, a chef.
Okay, and my final question, the book, podcast or discovery that changed my life is what? I'm always looking for book inspiration. Anything at all?
Oh, you will have read it, but it's my gift to most of my coaching clients, Atomic Habits by
Love
James
Atomic
Clear,
Habits. Yes.
It's just such a mean, there's a reason why it always tops the charts and has done ever since it came out, because it's so well written. And it's another one of these things. It's not rocket science, but when you can get the concept of making tiny, minute atomic changes, moving you in the direction that you want to go, it becomes a habit. And that it's such a great book. If you haven't read it, go out and grab a copy.
Brilliant. I co-sign. Emma, thank you so much for your time today. Where can people find you, connect with you, or work with you?
So my handle is at moneywhisperer_, and my website is themoneywhisperer.co.uk. And if you are interested in taking the money assessment quiz, you can add a #quiz to the end of that website address, and it will take you through to the money personality assessment.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Emma. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips, and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review, and subscribe. See you next time.